Are you struggling to find the right professional talent for your project? Are you working with a limited budget?
We are so excited about our next sponsor, Casting Networks. I have personally used Casting Networks to release a number of projects for free to the industry's largest network of professional performers for my commercial work and for my very first short film, Strange Thing.
Creators can manage submissions, schedule auditions, request and review self-tapes, and book top talent for their projects, all in one place. All for free.
On Casting Networks, you can create an account and send your casting call to thousands of professional talent. So join Casting Networks, the industry's preferred casting platform where more than 1.2 million performers have scheduled over 14 million auditions. That's a lot of auditions. Visit www.castingnetworks.com/movies to create an account for free today.
You know, making movies is hard.
Making movies is hard.
Welcome. This is the podcast about the struggle of being an independent filmmaker. I'm Mark Purcell, the founding host of the podcast, and I'm a sci-fi horror filmmaker, and my first feature film, The Alternate, is out now on all the places digital that you can buy it. The DVD is also available on Amazon, so you can get it very many ways.
I'm Liz Manischel. I'm a writer, director, producer who has made two features, Bread and Butter and Speed of Life. I'm currently in development on 8 more. I'm a distribution consultant who used to manage Sundance's Creative Distribution Initiative.
This week, we welcome writer-director Zoe Elise Salnave on the show to talk about directing her first feature, Voodoo Macbeth, as a USC grad student, what it was like working with 9 other co-directors, and how the film has impacted her career now that it is about to be released theatrically. After the interview, don't go away because we have another installment of The Game, and I'll ask Liz about the importance or non-importance of reviews. But first, Liz, what have you been up to?
I love it. It's like, Ulrich asks Liz. Ulrich, you ask me. What am I up to? I had to write it down. I am just waiting for rejection. I am just like every minute refreshing my email, just being like, when is this rejection coming? I know it's coming. When is it? Just rip off the Band-Aid. I just want it to happen already. We will announce this later, but we are going to a film festival that I submitted my short film to. And I know like that they've made selections because I'm EP on another movie that got in, and I'm trying to like worm my way into someone giving me an early rejection. Like I'm friends with like the former program director, and I'm like, can you just find out for me? And he's like, there's still a chance you weren't rejected. And I was like, Harrison, it's not going to happen. Just tell me. So what am I up to? I'm refreshing my email to be rejected by Austin Film Festival. And then a colleague of mine got into the Half Initiative, and I've applied for 3 years straight. And, you know, they may still be making selections, but I'm just waiting for them to email me and say, no, you didn't get in, Liz. And then just to like eat pizza afterwards, right? So maybe, I just got a new email. Was it them? Let's just look really quickly. It's not them.
Oh, man.
Damn it.
I know that feeling. I know the refresh feeling.
I hate it so much.
It's killer, man.
What are you up to? Probably much more exciting things than waiting for rejection.
Well, I think we should just announce it right now because I want to announce it near the front of the show, not the end of the show. So
okay, and I already kind of said it. Sorry.
We are going to the Austin Film Festival. The podcast will be there. Liz, myself, and Eric. It's going to be fantastic. And we have a very exciting special guest we have to announce.
Yes.
I want to do the honors just because I'm a big fan. Craig Mazin will be on the show. Oh, my God. And I think most people listening to this will know who he is. Anyone else I talk to in the real world, like who don't listen to a filmmaking podcast, doesn't know who Craig Mazin is. But they should, because he is an incredible writer. He's the showrunner of shows such as Chernobyl and the upcoming The Last of Us, which is incredible. I can't wait for this freaking show. There's so much hype around it. And I love the games. I played all the games. But anyway, so Craig's going to be on the show. It's incredible. I can't wait. I mean, I listened to like, when I was listening to podcasts, Script Notes was my favorite podcast. It is why this podcast exists originally, because I was listening to Script Notes and wishing like, why don't Craig and John talk more about director stuff? Why is all stupid writing stuff all the time? I was like, this should be a director show that's just like Script Notes, but for directors. And at the time, there wasn't one. So then I was like, well, let's do one. And then, of course, you know, the Just Shoot It guys did it at the same time. So there was like, now there's two, which is great. So I don't know, super inspired by Craig and John and August, you know, for their show. And, you know, I love Craig's point of view. So I'm fanboying over Craig too much, but I won't do it when we actually interview him. Because, yeah, I kind of related to Craig a lot. Always in the show, and he's a gamer. I'm a gamer. Anyways, I'm gonna keep it on the cool when we actually actually
talk. Yeah, when we talk to him, you'll... But no, but the enthusiasm helps. And also, yeah, I really buried the lead and I made it very selfish. Like, we're going to the Austin Film Festival. It's a fantastic film festival. Very excited for everyone who got accepted by the Austin Film Festival. We are going to Texas. I will be eating tacos. You will be eating tacos. There's lots to look forward to.
Yeah, I've also been rejected by the Austin Film Festival for every movie I've ever made.
This is a fun trip already.
I always thought I wasn't going to go unless I got in. And like, well, but here's the next best reason to go to the Austin Film Festival besides getting in is to be there to interview people and do a live show. We're definitely going to do a live show. We don't know what that is yet. We have some very exciting things about that we can't announce yet because they're not official. But yeah, it'll be a lot of fun. So if you're in Austin, come out and see us.
Yes.
If you're not in Austin, you'll hear lots of great things that we do while we're out at Austin. So it's going to be so much fun. But yeah, what am I doing? Oh man, I'm like still recovering from the release of my movie. Feel like I, you know, drank a lot of alcohol when I didn't really. It just feels very draining. The whole experience of like reading about your movie, reading reviews, like watching video reviews of people video reviewing your movie.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, I don't know if you've ever, I think that maybe this is like a genre thing, but yeah,
they don't
like,
do it for like my indie dramedy, May December romance
movie. There's not indie drama video reviews out there, but I think there was like three I got from my movie, which was really awesome.
That's interesting.
And two positive, one negative. I'll take it. You know, whatever. You know, it's been fun. It's been interesting. I talked about it a little bit on the Patreon site. I did a couple of videos just talking about my feelings and what was going on and some of the things I've been doing. But yeah, I feel like the dust seems like it's kind of settled a little bit. Like, I don't think we're really going to get many more reviews or any more reviews probably. Feels like it's over, which is great, which is fine. I mean, you know, we got a 75% on Rotten Tomatoes, which is like...
It's great.
I think pretty fucking great. I'm pretty excited about that. With 8 reviews, I think. So like, you know, 6 positive, 2 negative. Not bad. Our rating is still not the best on IMDb. We are 5.5 out of 10 out of like 70 or 80.
Oh, we're like a 2.9. Do not even worry about that. It's like, we are like the bottom of the barrel. I think that's where trolls go to ruin our day, is IMDb ratings.
Where people go to make you feel bad about yourself.
Yeah.
Letterboxd is a little bit better. We're like 3.2 now, I think. We were 3.4 for a long time, but you know.
It's good.
Whatever, you know. I feel like I'm really happy people are watching the movie. There was a couple. So I have this like one linked to the trailer that's got like 167,000 views now. It's like still going up slowly. But there's a couple of people who, one person was like, watching this movie right now, not as bad as I thought. Actually pretty good. 30 minutes in, I recommend it. And then like somebody else was like, okay, I'll give it a shot. Like,
oh, that's cool. You're like live, you're in real time watching people engage with your film.
Like, oh, there's 2 sales. Cool. Very neat. Yeah, from strangers. So yeah, it's been exciting. You know, there's been a lot of action on my new movie that I'm working on. You know, we're kind of moving things forward. We had a meeting with a casting director. She's like working on another movie right now. So like sort of going to be slow with her activity, but like she's going to be in board to like help us, you know, approach some of these actors and starting to get some more intelligence on some of these people that we're trying to reach out to. I'm working on the script daily with the writer. We're like cutting it down. We've already cut like 9 pages out of the damn thing, which is great, and hoping to cut it some more. So yeah, that one, it's funny. It feels like it's moving like at light speed, although in reality, nothing's really happened. Like, we're still like in the same position as all the films that you're in development on. We're still like trying to put cast together. We're still just trying to like, you know, play that same game everyone else is playing. Like, you know, try to get the right cast that can get us the budget and move things forward. Although the team seems very enthusiastic about it.
Oh, like, as long as you're getting people responding to emails. You know what I mean? As long as people are, as long as there's momentum on your side, it doesn't really matter, right?
Yeah, exactly. So I'm actually watching my email for updates on that project, kind of the same way that you're looking for your rejection emails, which, you know, I think may not be rejections, because I do think like you're reaching out to all these people directly. If you were rejected, they would have just told you by now. So you must still be in the running somehow. So I feel like that's maybe a little bit of excitement.
Or people just like feeling comfortable saying negative things, you know, or he was too lazy. He was too lazy to ask, you know, and there's millions of reasons.
But I've done the same thing before. And then I've gotten people that, you didn't get in. Like, I literally like same situation where I've reached out to people and they're like, oh no, yeah, you didn't make it. You know, I'm like, oh, okay, cool. Thanks. You know, so I think if you didn't make it, they would have told you. Although I have gotten the same thing as you where they're just like, we can't tell you until the date. Gotta wait for the date. I'm like, I know I didn't get in. Just tell me. And then of course
we do it in casting, you and I, right? Like you don't tell the people that you don't want them until you have the person you want who says yes and they've signed a contract. You have to have your backup plan. But I think that there should just be this level of kindness in rejection for the people who are not on the bubble. Like if you're not on the bubble, let them loose. I've talked about this in the podcast before, but I run a Facebook group called Film Festival Notifications. And the idea is like, once you hear from a film festival, you just tell everyone else so that they know that they weren't told yet. And that means something to them, right? That means that they probably are not in the first run of selections. And I think that kind of chatter needs to happen in this industry because the powers that be want to keep us in the dark. So this is part of like a global problem that I have with how this industry communicates with each other. And so I just want the Band-Aid ripped off. Like I want, just give it to me. Just give me that Band-Aid rip.
Yeah, yeah. Let me know.
Yeah.
The other thing that I want people to let us know is if you're a supporter on Patreon, you can go over to patreon.com/MMIH podcast, check out what we offer, what we're offering. And then the main thing that you're getting from being a Patreon is our love, of course. Yeah. And then also weekly staff meetings with Eric, Liz, and I, which are a lot of fun. And then bonus videos and bonus episodes. I swear we do have a bonus episode that's going to come out one of these days. I've got it like half, like it basically an hour and a half of work that I don't have to give it to it right now. But once I find an hour and a half, I will finish this damn bonus episode and I'll post it and it'll be out and it'll be great. But yeah, so check this out there. You know, makes a big difference for us. Don't also forget to check out Jambox.io. They are a royalty-free music and sound effects company with an emphasis on high-quality cinematic cues. Their composers have worked on soundtracks for Hollywood-level films, working with directors like Michael Bay and Martin Scorsese, and they even offer customized plans to fit your needs, which is pretty awesome. You can use our code MMIH to get a 20% discount today. But without any more further delay, here's our chat with Zoe Elise Selnave. We are here today with the wonderful Zoe Elise Selnave. Zoe, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Absolutely. Happy to be here.
Give us the elevator pitch for your film, Voodoo Macbeth.
Oh, gosh. I'm not ready. The elevator pitch. Voodoo Macbeth is a retelling of the very true occurrence of Orson Welles directing the all-black cast of Voodoo in Harlem during the Great Depression. And he centered it, instead of being in England or Scotland, he centered it in Haiti. And so that's where the voodoo part of Macbeth comes in. And it's sort of casted as close to reality, but it was the actual event that happened in the 30s.
Can you, just a bonus for other people listening, can you add a little bit of context of how the film was made? Just a quick summary of the multiple directors and where the film came out of.
Absolutely. So I was a graduate student at USC. USC does this thing every several years. I want to say about every 4 years, they have a program with Warner Brothers where they actually pair up. They staff a feature film, and it's with a number of directors that sort of get merited in this position. They're sort of put under a microscope for the duration of their graduate program to see how they direct, obviously, but interact, how collaborative they are, etc. And then sort of simultaneously, a writer's room is staffed to write the feature film. So they write it one semester, and then the next semester it goes off and gets filmed with the directors that get chosen. This one in particular, I think we just had a really good cohort. So we have 10 people that directed it. Previous iterations of this R project had directors, like about 8 of them. They all did different sorts of projects. We have the Thomasina. We've had previous movies that have actually gone into Netflix, which is kind of exciting.
I just want to make sure we still have you, or that you still have me. Can everyone hear me?
How many days did you shoot the film?
We recorded over 28 days. I think we maybe had a couple of pickup days, but that was our schedule, 28.
And was it full 12-hour days each day?
Absolutely. Wow. Grueling.
28.
Sometimes going from like 3 to 3. Many times, I don't know why, but that was my time slot, was to go till 3 in the morning.
Wow.
And at that point, really, nobody really wants to be working.
And so even though you were one of 10 directors, were you on set every day of the shoot?
I tried to be. So we had the option to like accompany our fellow co-directors, and we had all collaborated from the beginning on look, style, the way that we wanted to direct actors, you know, the way that we wanted to create the environment on set, etc. So like everything that we made up to the point that we started actually filming our own individual scenes have been really collaborative. So there was the invitation for folks to come sit in and, you know, a little bit of co-directing, but also we all wanted to give each other the space to do our scenes. We all did our own research on our scenes and things like that, but could be present. I'm in a number of scenes just because we needed more extras. So like many times I'm like in the crowds, I'm in the theater. I'm someone that like kind of brushes past Cameron for a transition during like a riot scene. So, you know, several of us got dressed up and got into character for some folks just to help out. And a couple of us were just there for like emotional support for the other directors.
That's awesome. If you can say, what was the rough budget of the film?
So it's a little difficult to say, to calibrate, but because we got so much student discounting and because we got so much like in-kind donation of like space, equipment and things from Warner Brothers, I think we spent about 200K, but when they've done the budget of what it would have been had we paid for things and had we paid for actors, right? Everyone was SAG deferred. It was about 2 million plus.
Ooh. Wow.
Yeah. This is a big production. We had big jibs. We had lots of rental cars. Like doing a period piece with no money is impossible. I don't know how we got that done, but we had great producers that did it. But it was a big undertaking.
Liz, can you ask the next question?
How did you come up with the idea?
So our sort of lead executive producer was a professor for us all. He comes up with the ideas for the scripts or finds the story for the script and then pitches it to the writer's room, which is a different semester than the folks that go and do the directing. So after he pitches it, it becomes a really collaborative process with that class, all really advanced writers and filmmakers, et cetera. And so they all dove in and did the research on the actual time period, the actual event of the thing about Orson Welles himself, and then about sort of what Haiti meant in the 1930s, which is a very different thing of what it means now. It actually was like a vacation destination and just had much less war and crime as it does now, sadly. But I think with the film, we were able to give it a really nice justice and really play into the fun and the culture and art element.
And then how long did you spend working on the film from like being brought on as a director to it being released?
I mean, in total, we're still going and it's been about 4 years. The directing of it all happened within a semester. The editing of it happened within a year. And then ever since we released in February of 2020, so right before everything shut down, sadly, we did have our premiere. We had like a carpet, pictures, you know, posters and things like that, luckily. And since that point, our sort of lead producer has been pushing it and getting it into, you know, hands and seen by eyes. And so it's recently got a distribution deal and it's coming out into theaters.
I'm like tabling 15 more questions about that. So am I to assume this is your first feature? And then compared to all the other projects you made in film school and before, how difficult was this one?
This is my first feature. This one was, how difficult was it? It's sort of hard to answer. And it's like, if you like being a filmmaker, then you like those challenges, right? And those late nights and all of the weird shit that you end up saying was like the moment the magic happened, right? I think it's harder when you have less crew. On this guy, we had crew, we had support, we had a lot of folks that were really dedicated to it, which was really cool. I feel like I've done so many student films and short films and things where you're really begging for favors and really trying to piece together like momentum. And this had a lot of spirit in it. Folks were really dedicated to it. I mean, getting folks to like Burbank at 3 a.m. is no easy feat, but folks did it in, you know, the dozens. So I want to say that like all of that kept me going a lot. So I think this one was actually incredibly fun, challenging in the way that it was so much material to get, but we all sort of thought about it like every day we're making a little bit of a short film. And then, you know, when you put it together, it became a longer version.
Zoe, I went to USC and I graduated in 2010. I did the MFA program. Yeah. So I'm, you know, fight on whatever.
Yeah.
But we didn't have anything like this, right? So this, I think the Don Quixote feature was the first one.
Yeah.
So I'm just like, first of all, in awe that USC got their shit together to make this happen. That is amazing. But also like aware that John Watson was a big part of that. Could you talk a little bit about John Watson's role?
Sure, absolutely. So John Watson was like the lead professor for this. He is an esteemed and renowned producer. He produced Robin Hood back in the day and several things since. And not sure what his impetus is in creating such a chaotic class, but But I think it's the idea that giving the students this very real life experience on set filming a feature film. And I think that's what we all wanted to go to, you know, big picture, if we wanted to go into television or film, but either way, going into long form, going into something, you know, studio or studio adjacent, but having this level of professionalism, industry exposure, a level of responsibility beyond like you just making your little personal short film to sort of assuage your childhood stories. It was like a bigger undertaking. It had all these like stakeholders. It was this bigger thing. And so I think that's what he, you know, ultimately wants is for us to get that experience and to also, you know, create a really cool movie. They've done one more of these since Voodoo Macbeth. It's another movie based in the theater, which we all think is really funny, but they're doing Phantom of the Opera currently. But this guy, I believe, was a lot of fun for John Watts. And I think he was really interested in making this one do well and be a, you know, a good product that would get some distribution and get out into the world.
So since you made the film and you graduated from USC and you've gotten out into the world as a director, like, how has this helped you? Like, do you feel like this has kind of had an impact in your experience, like, you know, going into the world as a freelancer, or has that not yet kind of that impact not been felt yet?
Yeah, I would say that I freelanced before USC. I've been working in film since I was 15. My freelance stuff was pre me getting my MFA. So immediately after school, I worked at Imagine Entertainment. I worked at Showtime and was in a totally different world than freelance. The impact that Voodoo is having now, sort of 4 years later, I am feeling in my career and sort of like certain doors opening and things like that. Like, of course, you know, we all want a manager and an agent, etc. And so like those doors are opening now, but it is a bit, you know, a bit distant from when we filmed it, which was in, you know, 2018-19.
Can we talk a little bit about distribution and also casting in relation to distribution? When I was there, USC didn't have any classes on distribution, and we all left being like, what do we do? I don't understand. Right. We didn't, like, we had a pitching class and that was it. With 10 directors in a class format, I understand that your producers had a certain level of autonomy, but did you feel any sort of pressure to cast for distribution, for marketing, or was it that you used that SAG agreement that USC has and you just found the best people?
A little bit of both, but there was a lot of pressure to make sure that we casted well for it and casted some names. We have Jeremy Tardy, who's on Dear White People, the series on Netflix, and several other folks, Inger. All of our leads are our faces. We had the pressure. We also really wanted to cast it well. We wanted it to be appealing. Our casting director is renowned. Twinkie is known all over, and she's known for casting really well Black actors and period and all sorts of things. And so having her name attached to it as well, and she came on as an executive producer to help continue to push this film, all of those elements helped with securing distribution. The distribution world has not been in my hands at all. It's definitely all of our producers' work, but it was most definitely on our minds that we wanted to have really strong faces, really strong actors, like folks who are really going to, you know, play a part in being on that poster, as well as folks who were into the role, because it was a bit of a strange project. You know, taking direction from 10 directors is a little bit crazy, but they were all really good sports. And we made sure that as a unit, we were really together and had our shit together so that we weren't confusing anybody and weren't creating sort of, you know, parallel worlds at all, that we were really all functioning in that same, you know, voodoo world.
But USC was effectively acting as the studio, right? So it's like, unless I'm wrong, unless this was like a 582 where you had your own ownership of, sorry, I'm reverting back to USC.
So you're
like
good.
Class numbers. you understand this because this is how we talk.
Yep.
USC.
Yep. Yep.
But if they're effectively acting as the studio, do you have to come to a quorum internally amongst the 10 directors and then go to the professor and then go to, you know, whoever's responsible for financing? Like, how many chains of approval do you have to go through?
Sure. We had a chain of approval pretty much within us and then with John Watson. Mm. There was, I believe, one point where we did a full presentation for a Warner Brothers exec, came to our class, sat in the theater, and we played through the slides and presented him with like our look and feel, the way we wanted to do aesthetic, the casting that we had in mind, etc. And they were pretty hands off. As far as I know, you know, maybe John was on the phone with them a lot, but they were very cool about us having a lot of free reign. they opened the doors up to the studio and we were in their like Brooklyn back lot and had an immense amount of freedom, I would say. We did, but like, I'll say it again, we had to have our shit together. And I think John Watson was there like at the beginning, sort of oversight and making sure that we were working together well, cooperating, et cetera, and that we had a plan. And once we proved that through multiple steps, we all had to kind of mockly shoot a bit of our scenes to show that we knew how we wanted to set up camera, that we knew about direction that we wanted to go in. And then once we were able to prove it, we sort of just operated like we got this.
So you talked about before, like getting, when you're doing this project, you were like under a fine microscope as a director. How was the process to be selected as one of the 10 directors? Was that like a really long process of like trying to, you know, interview and prove yourself, or like, what was that about?
So when I said that, what I meant is that from the beginning of you entering into the MFA program, you're being watched. You're being watched by all of the chairs of the departments. You're most definitely, they try to have a pulse on every, or they try to have a thumb on everybody's pulse. There are, you know, like chairs sort of fighting over students a bit, I will say. I was told many times that I can't try to produce and direct, but I needed to choose a track. And that was by a chair who wanted me to be in her track. And it's fine. I will say that I'm a creative director full time now. So thanks a lot for that. Feel free to pop that in. There's no bad blood there. They're watching to see what tracks you gravitate towards. And they're watching to see how, I would say, successful you sort of are aimed to go, what path you're leading towards. And I believe, you know, for a part of it, they're trying to help guide you towards something that you're going to be most successful in. I think sometimes they absolutely, you know, deter people in the wrong direction or are very unhelpful. But the idea, once you get to the more like advanced classes, which are the ones where they're giving you funding or they're giving you permission and they're giving you the insurance, or this class where they are, you know, oversighting a partnership with a Warner Brothers studio, they're making sure that you can fill those positions successfully, because USC's name does get attached to this for the remainder of its life. And ultimately, if it does well, right, that's a lot of public, that's a lot of great publicity for, you know, USC.
I'm just curious, like, how, like, because there's more than 10 directors in the MFA program, right? So like, how did you get selected as one of the 10, I guess is the main question.
Yeah. So there's about 50 people per cohort. Folks split it into about 5 different tracks, but there's no like definitive. You're never getting a degree in editing. You're not getting a degree in directing. Sure. You're getting a degree in production. But just once you start, you know, you take an intermediate course, you get into the advanced course, and you can kind of stick with that thing and get into different waves of sound design, different ways of, you know, editing, or you go into gaming or et cetera. For directing, there's different paths to what you'd like to direct. There's like a television directing class. There's documentary directing classes. There's classes you can take where they, like I said, they give you sort of permission. They oversee your project and they give you the university's insurance to go make it. But it's sort of a self-run project on your own. And then there's a couple of classes that the school completely oversees, funds, et cetera, which is this one and 546, which is a short form, super competitive class to try to get into. How do they select them? I don't know. You know, I think for this one, so there are classes like 546 where you sort of audition to be a director or producer. I produced once for that class. I tried to direct twice and got denied, which was heartbreaking. For that one, you put yourself into the mix to try to be a part of the class. For this one, for the feature class, you get selected a bit. Like, I got an email saying you're being like considered for this class. Then there was a questionnaire to answer. There was like a short conversation with John Watson and he pitched the story and sort of gauged the interest. I've never been a huge like Shakespeare fan, but I really liked the idea of centering it in the Caribbean. I have family that are Haitian and was like, yeah, this is so cool. I love the idea of it being in the Great Depression and being sort of about that Harlem Renaissance time. And so I think that that was probably part of it. I think each of the directors had some sort of cathartic thing with the story, and that might have helped us sort of narrow it down a bit as well. Yeah. Yes.
I'm getting flashbacks. I did 547, but all my friends tried to do 546. Nice. It's very heartbreaking for them as well.
Yeah. Heartbreaking. Like, a friend of mine had me on like suicide watch, which is a joke, but I'm like, right. Like, woof.
Yeah.
546.
Well, can you talk a little bit about post-production? I mean, are we looking at, was this thought of as like an anthology in post-production? Like, you had your own part and you oversaw that? Or was it all 10 overseeing the arc of the whole film?
It was much more of an anthology model. We all oversaw our episode, essentially. You could come in and out of like the editing session. We had one single editor, bless his heart, and he was able to do all of that. And we could come in and see what was going on, but we pretty much all stuck with our episodes. And then we did, I believe, at the end, we did like an overview watch of it.
So I'm really curious about, like, you know, you graduated USC, you worked for these, like, you know, big companies. Now you're in Northern California, right?
Mm-hmm.
So out of all the people that we've talked to at USC, most people don't move away from Los Angeles. They usually stay. So what drove you to Northern California?
Yeah, a couple of things. The pandemic was a huge shifter. There was a moment where the governor of California was like, we might do martial law. And my mom was like, get home right now. And it's like, okay. That was the first time like me in a suitcase had come back home for a chunk of time. And it had to do with being like furloughed from Imagine and, you know, not necessarily wanting to go back into that space due to just like there's a lot of dues to be paid, et cetera. And I don't knock that at all. But some of the studios are really hard to navigate up, especially if you feel like you're a really creative person with a lot to offer and don't necessarily fit that sort of mold that they need folks to kind of go through in those spaces. That's my very diplomatic way of saying.
Here's your coffee. Yes, sir. No, sir. Thank you very much. Ah, yes. Right away, sir.
Yeah.
No problem.
Yeah. Exactly. I was working like as a very, very junior sort of creative assistant and just knew that I could do more. And when I left there, when I went to Showtime, it was completely from home until we went into production. So for like a quick stint, I was in New York and doing that and was just there for a single season of Couples Therapy, which I absolutely loved. I had a great time. New York is not my favorite place. I'm very much a Bay Area person and just feel at home here. And so when I made the decision to like try to make it work here, you know, I was like, we don't all have to go to LA, and LA's traffic is fucking insane. And just through divine intervention, found a good job where I could be a creative director, have so much creative freedom, and, you know, be able to work on projects, you know, small and large, and do the thing that I really want to do, and also have my sort of stuff on the side that I'm still producing. It's just worked out. I'm a happier person in the Bay Area than I was in LA as well.
Nice.
Can you talk a little bit about the model that was created by the class and whether you think it's a sustainable model for filmmaking? I mean, I don't know what other projects you have in the books right now in terms of features and whether you're using multiple directors or just you as a director. But I'd be curious if there are any benefits to that type of major collaborative effort.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's a huge benefit to it. I think when we were all in it, we were like, this is crazy. And how is this going to work? And we're all such different people. But the benefit is huge. I mean, we all got to shoot a feature, sort of like point blank period. Signed, sealed, and delivered, we made a feature. And to have that kind of experience, you know, like it might be another couple of years. And so we're all on a set so large on a backlot of a major studio working with major, you know, Stagdorford actors, bless their hearts. But all of those elements is sort of like, you know, kind of once in a lifetime or once in a decade sort of experience. So I think it's great. It's crazy when you're in it. Looking back on it, I wouldn't have changed it for anything. I think it was an absolutely right choice for me to make and to be involved in. I would not necessarily do it again. Like, I don't think it makes sense to have 10 directors on a feature, especially once you're sort of like out and seasoned and experienced. You don't need so much support. But at our kind of, I'll say, tender age of being in school, it was nice to have somebody to turn to and say, like, are we doing this right? Would you do it differently? Like, how are we going to tackle this together? All kind of aided and like added to our bucket of skills, what we could all do. Because we did come from different ways of working, totally different, you know, streams of thought, different ways of being creative. We all had different ways of even working with the actors. Some of us were like super involved with the actors, and some folks wanted to sit in the chair behind Video Village and have that separation. Meanwhile, I was like barefoot and in the scene with everybody, but that's just direct. But it was interesting, right? You can get different things from seeing different people's style so up close. You know, we're not like reading the book of what David Lynch did on, you know, XYZ. You're physically there with another director watching their process and like able to absorb, you know, anything that works for you. You're able to absorb from them.
Nice. Yeah, just a comment. I mean, there's a good chance like a lot of directors never get to make a movie for $1 million or $2 million or whatever to sort of be on those kinds of that kind of level with that kind of crew and that kind of set and everything. Like maybe that won't ever happen again. And I mean, and that's not like it's a bad thing, like making movies for $500,000 or whatever or less or is totally a noble thing. It's just
totally.
I think it's a pretty amazing experience that you had is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, absolutely.
But what I wanted to kind of circle back to is like you said that now, like, you know, 4 years later after the press release and being a Deadline and like the trailer coming out and doing so well and all that stuff, like you're starting to see doors open. And I'm just curious, like, in what way are you just getting like cold outreach from people like saying, hey, like, I want to represent you? Or are you reaching out to managers and agents and getting positive responses? Like what kind of things in detail, if you're willing to discuss, are happening now at this stage?
Yeah, I'm not willing to discuss.
Ooh, ISIS out. All right, fair enough.
Sorry. I'll give you an update, but we had a New York Times article come out yesterday, which was kind of cool.
Oh, nice.
Deadline in New York Times and whatever that equals to you in your mind. I'm protecting. I'm protecting a nugget right now.
Protect away. I want to talk a little bit about benefits of it as well, though, but maybe you could speak to this. You know, I assume that Warner Brothers and USC had their grubby little mitts over everything in terms of the future of how this film is exploited, how it's marketed, the returns, the revenue, rights, windows, territories, everything. You could please feel free to correct me. But did going through this process and then having to step away for distribution, did that inform whether you want to or do not want to be involved in that in the future?
Mm-hmm. Yes, lots of people had their grubby hands over it. USD also recoups their investment plus some from any money that the film makes.
You weren't paid, right? There's no, I didn't miss that you got some sort of fee for doing. Okay, please go on. Correct. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, no problem. We didn't get paid. The actors didn't get paid. Everyone was on sort of defer payment. We do have a number of SAG folks that need to be paid sort of like after USC recoups, then the SAG folks recoup, actors, not SAG, which I don't even know if anyone was at SAG. And then we'll get, you know, $10 at the end or a gift card or something to In-N-Out. It definitely informed the way that like I'd want to be a director. I've been a producer and a director separately and together for a long time. And there are certain moments of producing that are just made for a different mindset. You have to be like business savvy, a manager, a supervisor is totally fulfilling work. And I have loved doing that. And then now sort of at the place that I am in life very much, I'm really enjoying being that creative mind to a project. And being able to rely and trust a producer is so nice. So I'll say that, like, yes, it's informed that I don't want to deal with distribution. I just want them to call me and say, okay, here's the release day and this is when your Q&A section is. But it's a part of, like, you have to kind of go through the reins of seeing what it's like to produce and seeing what it's like to be good at producing and to find folks that are, like, really naturally inclined to do that. We all know people who are just like natural producers and can handle it to the T. And it's an art form in and of itself. And just like at this point in my life, I don't know, since my birthday, I've just really enjoyed being like creative.
Nice. So, you know, this is your first feature. You didn't write it. Most first features from most independent filmmakers are ones that they wrote because it's just like out of necessity for the most part. So do you feel like having done it that way, like, are you like now, oh, yeah, director for hire, like, give me an awesome script, I want to direct it? Or are you kind of more reverting to like, oh, no, I want to write my own thing as my next project?
I mean, you know, if anybody wants to hire a director to direct a feature, I'm available. I very much want to do my own stuff. I have, you know, stories I've been working on for years that are like my babies. And those are the things that I want to direct for sure. But of course, like would not knock an experience to do a feature is, again, it's an experience you don't just come across and it blows your mind, you know, no matter what it's going to be, no matter how much money is involved, et cetera. But to get that amount of people together, like rooting for the success of this movie, creating, you know, something out of nothing, you know, if the opportunity were to arise, you have to do it.
Like going through that process of, you said you learned a lot about directing and like kind of like finding your own voice as a director. Like, but what's like one big takeaway from your experience directing Voodoo Macbeth that has like kind of informed you, you know, in your directing, you know, your future directing?
The big thing that I took from directing Voodoo Macbeth was how much I love directing. And that's, it's sort of as simple as that. It was all of the crazy things that you could imagine. It was all of the fires that would happen on set. It was all of the craziness, all of the like late night strange food, extras not showing up, you know, meltdowns in the wardrobe department, etc. But like incredibly fun. It's, you know, it's like I used to tell my mom, like, I know I'm calling you and I'm venting, but I really do love what I'm doing. Like, I know I'm calling you with like all of these tragic things, right, that make it sound like this thing is just not going to work. Because at one point she was like, this movie just isn't going to happen. And I was like, no, the movie's happening. I'm just venting. I had a long day on set. But that's sort of the very cool part of it to me. Like, I love that there's always some kind of chaos to figure out. And again, like, those are those moments where that magic happens. And somehow we, again, make something out of nothing. But like, you get something on screen, you get something recorded on tape, and you make a movie with it. Kind of amazing.
Nice. I have one last question. So basically, coming out of school, like, you're way ahead of most of us, right? Like, you've directed your first feature. Like, that doesn't usually happen for, like, you said, a few years or whatever. You know, and I know that you said you came out of the experience, like, loving directing and, like, kind of, like, growing as a director and kind of, like, finding your voice as a director. But do you have a sense of, like, what you see your future like? Like, do you want to be, like, a feature director and, like, that's what you're focusing on? Are you, like, trying to go into television? Like, does it matter to you? Are you just, like, trying to direct whatever you can? Like, has any of that kind of stuff, like formulated in your mind over the last few years?
Yeah, absolutely. Right now, I want to just be directing. So, like, even being a creative director in, like, this commercial kind of corporate ad space is working, right? Because it's still sort of working my director's muscle and refining skills, like, continuously learning about the newest equipment, lenses, cameras that are coming out still. And so I can say, like, oh, now I know that I want to go use the Komodo when I'm shooting my whatever, right? Had I not been working actively in the field, if I'd been behind a desk, you know, scheduling somebody's coffee meetings with musicians and actors, I wouldn't know what's kind of going on in the world. I wouldn't really have my finger on the pulse. So I get a lot out of actively working as a director, even currently, even if it's not like the exact thing that I want to be doing. And then bigger picture, I want to be a feature director. I would love to work in television, you know, for hire on seasons and, you know, episodes, or on series and episodes, not seasons.
Or seasons too. You could do a whole season. People do that. That happens these days.
Right.
Just a quick shout out to Glass and Marker, which is where Zoe and I both work. These guys all rock. They're all going to be hearing this. I'm going to share it with them all, whether Zoe wants it or not. So
no, absolutely. Share it away. Hi, Glass and Marker. I love you.
I think we'll be doing a rapid fire round of our last questions. As a reminder, these are the questions we ask every guest. And so the first question is, what's the first film you ever made? It doesn't have to be feature. What's the first film you ever made and how do you feel about it now?
First film I ever made was probably, you know, I think I made other ones right before this, but they were all practice. But I made a short documentary 2009. So I was very young. And it was to document my experience at this like garden program in Berkeley. And it was incredibly successful at some festivals. It went all over the world. And it was so weird. I was like 16, 16 and a half. Wow. And I had someone helping me enter into all these festivals. But he kept being like, hey, Zoe, you're going to come to another festival. Hey, Zoe, you're going to come to another festival. And I have all of these posters and like mementos from all these different festivals, like all across my desk and all around my room. And I actually got a resolution from the state of California for my work in film from this little documentary that I made when I was 16.
Wow.
And I have that up. It's framed in this like gorgeous gold thing and signed by the senators of California. And so, like, that I'm so proud of. And that is what changed my life, because once I saw that I could be successful and tell a cool story that was like super personal to me, man, I opened the thing and I'm like, hi, my name is Zoe and I used to be a student at the school. It was just cathartic for me to talk about being in this program when I was a middle schooler and to see that resonate with people like beyond the borders of Berkeley or Oakland or, you know, just the Bay in general was mind-blowing. It got me where I am now.
Wow. Amazing. What's the best filmmaking advice you've ever received?
The best advice that I got was that you can't do both, because I was like, why not? I'm going to go do both. And I've done both.
And it's producing and directing?
Producing and directing.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's bullshit. I've done both too.
Totally. Yeah.
Screw you guys.
What's the worst advice? Just the worst filmmaking advice, bar none.
Worst filmmaking advice. What's the worst filmmaking advice? I know I've gotten a lot. I think just But what's coming to mind for me is like taking advice from anybody that doesn't understand where you're coming from. So taking advice from anybody that doesn't have their mind open at all can really mother creativity and makes it so you can't even sort of figure out an out way, you know, or you can't even figure out an entry point with that person, which is tough. And that exists sort of all throughout filmmaking. So I think the way to sort of combat that is protect your heart, protect your art, by making sure that like when it's young and fresh and like really vulnerable, that you're bringing it to folks that are going to understand it so that it can grow and have some strength on its own to be able to go up against the people who may not and who may ask questions about it.
Wow. Amazing. Do you have a goal as a filmmaker?
Yes, to be very successful.
How do you define the success though? That's what we talk about that a lot on the show. It's like, what does success mean?
Yeah. Success means like getting it in front of a lot of people. You know, that idea of, you know, having it in theaters and for like all kinds of people that you never, you know, it's not just your friends that you ask to come to the screening in the backyard. It's like folks you have no idea, you know, you've never crossed paths with coming in and watching a movie in the theater. It's amazing.
If you could go back in time, what's the piece of advice you'd give yourself?
You've got this. Trust yourself. Keep going.
Final question. Is making movies hard?
Oh my God. If someone said it's not hard, they're lying.
We have a few people, 5 or 6.
Yeah, who says it's not? It is hard. It's hard work. It's hard work. It, you know, I hate when people act like filmmaking is, like, I hated when people would say, oh, you're in art school. I'm like, I'm not, you know, and no snuff to art school, but I was like, I'm not in a studio painting by myself. Filmmaking is coordinating 100 people to be at one place at one time and to be on the same fucking mindset to make a story that does not exist. It's like, it's doing the impossible. It's hard work. If you're, you know, good at it, maybe it gets easy at certain points, but it's a job.
So Zoe, where can people go to find out more about you and Voodoo McDeath? Where should we go? It's a plug time, plug time.
Plug time, plug time. I mean, feel free to, you know, follow me on Instagram and blow it up. You'll see some personal stuff mixed in with professional stuff. I'm also at my website, zoesalnov.com. You can Google me and find me on IMDb, etc. We've got an article up on Deadline. We've got an article up on New York Times for Voodoo McDeath. But I'm all over. I mean, you know, Google me, baby.
Are you a writer with a great screenplay just sitting on your desktop? Are you looking for written analysis of your work by experienced creatives? Are you trying to get industry professionals to read your work, but you don't know how to reach them?
Then enter the Blue Cat Screenplay Competition. Created by veteran screenwriter Gordon Hoffman, the Blue Cat Screenplay Competition has helped unknown writers launch their professional careers for over 25 years.
This year, the Blue Cat Screenwriting Competition will award $18,500 in cash, and everyone who enters will receive a written analysis on their work, and getting feedback on your script is worth, like, a lot.
The deadline to enter is October 30th, but if you miss it, you could still catch their late deadline on December 11th.
Check them out on the social medias at Blue Cat Writers on Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube.
So stop waiting to be discovered and send your feature screenplay, TV pilot, and short film script to Blue Cat today.
Also, don't forget, we have a 10% discount code for your submission to Blue Cat, so use the code BCHARD23 when you apply.
All caps.
All caps, baby. Liz, what do you remember about our talk with Zoe?
I remember I lost internet while we were talking, and I haven't heard, but I think there's probably an awkwardness to the beginning of the conversation where we'll see if Jeff keeps it in, where you two are probably like, where's Liz? What are we doing? Should we go forward? I don't know. And then I had to do the rest of the interview from my phone. So I remember that. I remember that Zoe and I went through the same program at USC. So there was kind of a little bit of, I was drawn to have like that inside joke ribbing experience with her, right? That I think a lot of USC alums like to have with each other. We've referenced like class names a lot and talk about how hard 508 was. So for me, it was like a reunion with someone I've never met. So that was really nice.
That's really sweet. I work with Zoe, so it was just really fun to chat with her outside of the confines of work and just kind of get to know her a little bit better as a filmmaker. I've definitely heard some about her work before, but it was really cool to get into the details, especially with this whole USC thing and like how this movie was made and what her experience was like. It kind of sounds like it was sort of like getting a preview of what it would be to direct like a $2 million movie. Yeah, although the movie budget wasn't actually $2 million, but it was like the resources they had and the way it was made was as if the movie was that kind of budget. So it seemed like a really incredible experience. And basically, like, if I was a film, if I was a student trying to get into film school, I would be like, fuck all the other film schools. I want to get into USC where you actually get the chance to make a movie potentially.
Well, Chapman did that too. I don't know if it still does, but Chapman was the one that led the way. I just wanted to give Chapman some love because I think that USC is actually emulating the Chapman program.
Oh, I didn't know that. I know some people who went to Chapman. I don't know much about Chapman, but apparently it's pretty cool. I know that Colin Hanks went to Chapman. So.
Well, they have a lot. They had a lot of great equipment and studio space. USC clearly does as well. And I'm not going to, whatever, I'm really proud to be from USC. But something about USC that has a chip on its shoulder, right? It's like, oh, they have it. Oh, we'll do that. And we'll do it with Warner Brothers. You know?
Okay. Well, here's the two things I have about USC that I've learned in my career as a, you know, in video production, filmmaking, whatever. We did a shoot at USC at the track. And when we were there, they were shooting a scene for Veep on campus at the same time. And your shit was fucking nice, dude. Like, that's a nice ass campus. I saw some people doing some film students doing some stuff and moving some gear around. It was pro gear.
Yeah.
You guys got it going on. No need for no chips on USC's shoulder. Your shit is tight. No worries.
Well, my joke is that, like, they tore down the old building in the cinema school and they, you know, they did this. They built a new one and it looks like a Las Vegas hotel. Like, I don't know if you've seen it, but you're just like, oh, the Bellagio. Like, it's just like there's like palm trees and it's very polished and it's excessively large for, you know, no one is hanging out inside because it's too sterile.
Oh, wow.
So there's just this weird optics thing that USC likes to participate in that. But whatever. Yeah, our stuff was good. We have good stuff.
Yeah, that's a pretty funny, like, perspective on the whole thing. Because I think from an outsider, it's like, wow, that's so epic. But then, you know, on the inside, it's like, oh, we made it just because we wanted to prove ourselves. But it's like, it doesn't really matter why. You know, it just, it's awesome. You know, so bottom line.
Go fight on.
Fight on. And you guys got a good football team, too, I think. So that's like,
go Cornhuskers, who are the worst team possible this year. We fired our coach.
Oh, man.
And yeah, whatever. I don't need to get into it. I can't even talk on this level.
Don't even get me started on the Raiders. Last week was embarrassing. Embarrassing. Hopefully what happened this last Sunday was less embarrassing for them. Okay, it's time for the game, Liz. I'm so excited to ask you this question.
I've got my pen. I'm taking notes.
Okay, here it goes. I got to do the voice because everyone likes it. You and Eric. Here is the question for the game. You've signed on to direct a musical. This is so Liz. I love it. It's a very big budget and includes a soundstage with elaborate sets, dozens of professional dancers, and an A-list actor as your lead. Sounding great. Yeah. The problem is the lead actor cannot sing or dance, nor are they willing to learn. Sounds familiar? They're only doing the film to fulfill a contract obligation. If you drop them, you'll lose your funding. But if you keep them, you'll have to film a musical with someone who can't sing. Do you A, drop the actor and just hope to find a different A-lister to take their place? B, drop the A-list actor and get a B-list musical theater actor who can definitely carry the show, but your budget will be dramatically reduced? C, overdub the actor and try to stage dance numbers where the dancers carry the scenes? Or D, other? What do you do, director? What do you do?
You dub them. There's like years, decades of musical theater films where the singer is not the... I mean, I think there's this one, oh my God, Jill Blackledge, and my husband will yell at me for not knowing this actress on hand, but there's one actress that played the musical theater voice for like Audrey Hepburn, for Deborah Carr, like a very fancy singer. I mean, I'll have to ask Sean in a second, but I think it's fine. I think it's fine to dub. Look at Singing in the Rain, the great story about dubbing. And then yes, for the dance numbers, you know, I don't remember Rex Harrison dancing his way through My Fair Lady, you know? I think there's a world where you can have kind of like a quote unquote straight man character who doesn't participate in the dancing. Cecily Strong in Brigadoon is not the strongest dancer in the world, but she, you know, she made an effort.
Yeah.
I wouldn't say Keegan-Michael Key is the best singer in the world, but he did his job on Brigadoon. You can surround your lead with a lot of classically trained, fantastic musical theater talent. Dubbing is fine. What did you think? What were you going to do?
Same.
Yeah.
I think you don't really have a choice, I think, because I think if you do any of the other things, your movie ends, like, right? Yeah. Like, I don't think you're going to have a big budget musical without a lead you know, that can support it, you know, unless somehow, like, you know, In the Heights happened, which is amazing because that guy's not a super famous or anything.
Anthony Ramos? Wait, who?
Yeah.
Oh, I love it. Yeah, Marnie Nixon. Sorry. I have to give Marnie Nixon is the voice for My Fair Lady and The King and I in West Side Story. Ah, Marnie Nixon. Nice. Yeah.
Yeah. Because Anthony Ramos is not a big name. It's not like Ryan Gosling or something, you know?
No, you're right. Yeah. He's a Broadway name, right? He was in Hamilton. Yeah. So.
Right. Right. But I mean, they did get that other guy who was in the NWA movie.
You know, oh, I love him. Oh my God. What is this? Great. He's in like three decks of mine as he's an actor I want to work with.
Oh, great. Oh my God. Yeah. I don't think he actually made any decks of mine, but I mean, I would love to work with him. He's fantastic.
Now I have to look. I'm just like Googling over here. Just.
But I wonder, did he sing in the Heights? What's his name? Ryan Gosling did sing in La La Land. I didn't think he did, but they didn't have him do any dancing, you know, which is totally like part of the answer, right? It's like you just.
Corey Hawkins.
Corey Hawkins.
I love Corey Hawkins. I don't know if he didn't, he really looks like he did. Like he looks so comfortable in that form. I would assume that that is his voice.
Yeah, apparently he did sing.
Yeah.
In the Heights. So that's awesome. Yeah, I mean, I feel like more and more these days, like, you know, people are got the singing down, you know, maybe not the dancing, but like, yeah. I know Hugh Jackman can sing and dance like nobody's business. So,
The Rock know. Can sing. The Rock in Moana is, and remember when he came out?
It's okay.
I thought he was lovely. I mean, he's
No, I don't know what.
He's no Hugh Jackman.
Robin Williams.
Sure.
Singing in Aladdin. I was at a park the other day that like is like a little park for kids, and they were playing all these Disney songs, and they played the Aladdin Genie song, but it was the Will Smith version.
Oh.
And it's like, no offense to Will Smith, but it's like, no one's going to be able to do this better than Robin Williams did. Like, there's just no way. You know, it's just pales in comparison. I did see that on Broadway, though, in New York, and the guy who did the Genie song on the New York Broadway thing was really great, but I think it was because of all the spectacle and the dancing and the blah, blah, blah that's happening on stage makes it better.
You've got like a CG blob with Will Smith in that movie, right?
I didn't even watch it. I couldn't.
Oh, I've seen it a lot because, you know, Colin, hashtag Colin.
Hashtag Colin.
But I think, you know, I thought actually, I loved La La Land and I thought Emma Stone and Ryan Gosling were fantastic in it. And I know there was backlash, right? Because they weren't the perfect singers and the perfect dancers, but they were great actors, I thought. And they had the heart of the film. And I thought that they were good enough. They were good enough for me to believe in them. So I'm okay with that.
Yeah. My main problem with La La Land isn't Ryan Gosling and Emma Stone, although I wish they did get people who could dance because they got the singing. That's good. But like they didn't do any of the dancing really. And like all the dancing numbers are with, you know, real dancers, which is great. But I mean, my biggest problem with that movie is just not enough singing and dancing for it to be a musical. It's like half a musical, half a drama.
That opening number, Another Day of Sun.
It's great.
That makes up for not having enough songs, I think.
It's great. And the one I really like a lot is the one after the party where they're like, you know, Ryan Gosling does a little like kind of singing dance number thing with Emma Stone
in the park
or whatever.
Yeah, the bench,
in the park.
Course,
oh my God. That was great.
Yeah.
But they just needed three more. Three or four more, you got me.
I would have taken. I would have taken musical. It. I'll always take more songs in a musical, but I'm a big fan. Big musical.
I enjoyed it. I definitely enjoyed La La Land more than most, I think. Or the more than the haters. Liz, do I have time to ask you this question really quick or no?
I'll try. Okay. Well, let's just try.
Are reviews important to the release of your film? Yes or no?
Okay. So when I pitch a film and it's in that kind of murky area, it's not a genre film, it's an indie drama. If I have a pull quote from Variety, it helps, right? If I can show the access that the film achieved and it's a positive review from the New York Times or whatever, it helps me for pitching distributors or platforms of distribution. In terms of, does it convert sales for audiences? You know, you and I talked to Ryan Davis from Smart House Creative. It's like, there's no way to track that conversion. You don't really know. I think word of mouth, and that's what I've heard, is that word of mouth is still by far the most important thing in deciding whether you go to see a movie or not. But if a film can punch above its weight class, so to speak, with a good review or a high profile outlet, it shows an audience, platform, and distribution company something about its reach and its power and its influence. So I do think reviews still matter.
I also think like in the very basic sense, it's like, you know, you got your movie. Your movie is now basically your calling card, right? It's like your business card for anyone who wants to work with you in the future on your next project. Right. And if someone looks up, you know, the alternate and sees a fresh rating on Rotten Tomatoes, that's going to have a better impact on them than if it was rotten, right?
Yeah.
Or had no tomato meter at all and just had a couple of reviews, you know, but if those reviews are positive, I still think that is going to be like, oh, it was a small movie. It got good reviews. It just didn't, you know, get that many, whatever. That's not the director's fault, you know? So yeah, I don't know. That's what I kind of, what I've kind of fallen down on is that it's just a good public perception of the movie, basically.
Hollywood respects scope, right? Like, that's why micro-budget filmmakers are always told, don't talk about your budget. Don't talk about how much you made with so little, because you appear more attractive if you have been in charge of more money. It's really a ridiculous thing. So if the optics of your film show a certain scope, like very few people can get a New York Times review without a really great publicist, and that publicist costs a certain amount of money, and that shows you that your film team has resources or a network. Like, it's all this like waterfall of deductions that people in Hollywood make. So if you're not in Tomatoes, then you're thinking, well, at least that film had the resources to have a press team to go out to those critics.
Right.
It's a very short judgment call that's being made, but it means something.
Yeah. Funny thing is, the majority of the reviews on Rotten Tomatoes are from my festival run or from a person I reached out to directly. So it's funny that, like, that's
but they
really
don't know.
The truth.
Right.
They don't know, right? Yeah. That's what actually happened, you know?
And you did the work. You put the work in to build the foundation to set yourself up for success.
Yeah. It's funny because when I was doing the festival release for the alternate, once I got distribution, my distributor and my producer told me, don't focus on reviews now because you want to focus on reviews when the movie comes out.
Right.
But it's like, oh, well, if I had focused on reviews for like the Otherworlds Film Festival, for instance, that was in Austin, and maybe the Austin Chronicle would have covered it at that time, but now they don't give a fucking shit because it doesn't have anything to do with Austin.
Right.
It's like, that would have been smarter to do. So now I'm like kind of going against my distributor's advice. And I feel like the next movie, if we do a festival run, it's like, okay, well, I'm going to hit up hard every single film festival, no matter if we have distribution or not. I'm going to try to get those reviews at the time because that's at least something that they can hold on to, you know?
Yeah. Or like, you ask Richard Whitaker at the Austin Chronicle for a feature coverage at that time, right? Or an interview or whatever it is. So it's still possible.
Shout out to Richard Whitaker. I think I emailed him the other day asking if he would review my movie.
Hey, Richard, do us a solid, hey, please.
Yeah, it's never too late. A late review would still be great. But yeah, that's all I got.
Well, all of you can always send us a question, comment, or suggestion to podcast@makingmoviesishard.com. If you like the show, you can leave us a review on iTunes. Check us out on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter at MMIH Podcast, YouTube at Making Movies is Hard Podcast. Support the International Screenwriters Association. We're big fans of theirs. The ISA is an organization designed to connect writers with filmmakers through a number of programs they offer. They do consultation courses. They publish your log line to a network of industry professionals. They do contests. Head on over to www.networkisa.org to sign up for free today. Thanks to Zoe Salnov for coming on the show. Thanks to our editor, Jeff Freimuth, for doing the editing. We love you, Jeff. We don't know you, but we love you. Thanks to our producer, Eric Toms, for being awesome. We also love you, Eric. Don't feel left out. Thanks to all of you for listening, and talk to y'all next week.
Welcome, welcome, welcome.
You know when you're listening to a true crime story that has an unbelievable plot twist that makes you stop in your tracks? That's what our podcast, People Are the Worst, brings you with each episode. I'm Rachel.
And I'm Rebecca. We're identical twins who love true crime cases that make you say, "Didn't see that coming," and we hate the people responsible for them. Listen to People Are the Worst now on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.